The next case on the court's calendar is Scott Cannarelli et al. Petitioner versus the 8th Judicial District Court. Real party in interest, Lawrence D. Cannarelli, Heidi Cannarelli, and Frank Martin for the Special Administrator for the Estate of Edward Louvers, former trustee. Case number 82299. Are counsel ready to proceed? Let's begin first with Mr. Poulsenberg and see if our sound system is working.
Your Honor, I am ready to proceed. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Mr. Williams, how are you today?
I'm good. It's nice to be back in front of you, although unfortunately it's by video. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. And Ms. Wiggins?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
And we can hear you as well. Thank you for your availability and willingness to participate virtually in this argument. As I've explained before, this is a safety measure, but also an opportunity for us to see you, even though you might not be able to see us or our smiling faces. Okay, let's proceed then. Mr. Poulsenberg, or are you going to argue? Okay.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, Dan Poulsenberg for the petitioner, Scott Cannarelli.
Oh, I do have one preparatory comment. We are aware of a pending motion with regard to a request regarding the review by the court of the subject information or the material. We will act on that motion following argument today. We direct the parties not to discuss or argue that material as part of their argument, however.
Very good. Thank you, Your Honor. Let me address that prefatory note first. I have not seen these documents. So if the court does review them, I think you need to let me review them as well. And in that situation, I may want to argue the case over again. But let me argue it in the first place. Disqualifying a judge is not supposed to be easy. And the rule adopted by the district court not only makes it so incredibly easy, the rule is even unworkable. When we look to disqualifying a judge, we look to the source of what that potential bias would be, whether it's judicial, or as some cases say, intrajudicial, or whether it's extrajudicial. And the rule in Nevada under Kirksey versus State and In re Dunleavy is that potential bias must stem from an extrajudicial source. Now, here's the general rule with extrajudicial source. If the bias, the alleged bias of a judge is from a judicial source, where the opinion is formed by facts introduced in current proceedings, the judge is only disqualified if she displays a deep-seated favoritism or antagonism. So when we look to disqualification generally, and I'm taking a step back, we look to whether there's actual bias or implied bias. Actual bias is pretty easy. Actual bias is when the judge has an actual bias against the parties stemming from an extrajudicial source. But implied bias we get from Rule 2.11. And that rule says that a judge must disqualify herself, recuse herself, remove herself, where her impartiality might be reasonably questioned. While that's the general rule, and that's the rule Judge Bell adopted as the standard, that's really so broad. And in fact, the general provision takes its color from the six specific examples underneath. Under the doctrine of a justem generis, a general provision gets its meaning from the specific provisions. And if you look at the specific provisions, it's like, the judge is a party, the judge's lawyer is a party, the judge has some interest in the case. These are the same as the NRS 1.120 implied malice. Now, somebody may say, Lane Rushforth, the probate lawyer, lives across the street from me. And so if I were the judge, some people might question whether I could be fair. That's not enough to be a disqualifying factor, especially if Lane were litigating against my daughter, which she would be a statutorily recognized category where I'd have to disqualify myself. So the judge just went with the broad standard, if a reasonable person would harbor reasonable doubts about a judge's impartiality. And the real reason from Judge Bell's decision why she went to a different standard rather than the recognized standard in Nevada was based on two cases that talked about reviews of privileged document. One was U.S. versus Zolin, the U.S. Supreme Court case, and the other was Lund versus Myers, the Arizona case. Now, U.S. versus Zolin from 1989 is a case where the court went off and talked about a hypothetical of in-camera review of military secrets. And they talked about how that might jeopardize the privilege. But there was no mention of recusal, no mention of disqualification. It was simply dealing with the crime fraud exception. In Lund versus Myers, that did deal with the in-camera review of privileged material. But all the court said there is the judge may consider whether to recuse herself. In fact, Lund versus Myers has a lot of qualifiers in what it said. It said if there is an in-camera, the court could consider whether another officer could review the materials. And because possibly the materials may be prejudicial. And the judge then could consider whether to recuse. It didn't find that those circumstances created implied bias or actual bias. And in this case, Judge Sturman did originally have another judicial officer hear the privileged issues. The discovery commissioner heard them. She only reviewed the materials when the trustees objected and brought the issue to her. And she said that she did not consider recusal to be necessary, that she wasn't biased, and Judge Bell found that Judge Sturman was not biased. She was just looking at the situation, what one of the briefs called the appearance of impartiality. Respondent has retreated from Judge Bell's justification. They don't cite U.S. versus Zolin in their answering brief at all, and Lund versus Myers is relegated to a footnote. So if we were to adopt this test, this reasonable doubts test, I mean, how is that possibly going to operate? Reasonable doubts to whom? To Ed Lubbers, who wrote the notes? Well, he was an experienced lawyer. He would understand that a judge could review documents and still be fair. In the District of Columbia Jackson case, they only went to the idea that disqualification would be necessary because of public appearances, because of the publicity. That's not the situation here. I've had a lot of lay clients, and a lot of them have thought whenever a judge ruled against them that the judge was biased. So it can't be an ordinary client standard.
Mr. Poulsenberg, what do you make of the fact that somewhere I read in the pleadings that Gott had claimed that without Lubbers' notes or this privileged material, he couldn't prove his case?
That's not the case.
Maybe I didn't read that correctly, but if that were the case and the privileged material were... Obviously, it's inadmissible. We're talking about a bench trial with Judge Sturman.
Well, let me address two parts of that. First of all, on the work product privilege, there is an exception to the work product privilege when information in the documents is necessary. But nothing in these documents was necessary to either side. In fact, the way we had characterized them in the district court was that these documents were admissions. And so we didn't need the admissions to prove the fact of the case. In fact, I think that's why they don't want them to be publicly known, because they are our admissions. let me jump ahead and see if I can handle that. Yes, and we're talking about the judge being the fact finder. Now, they've retreated from that position, saying that it's not a necessary element. They do say it's an element, the last element of their argument, that the judge is the fact finder. But here, I mean, we're talking about another general rule. In a bench trial, we presume that the judge bases her decision on admissible evidence and disregarded improper evidence. This court said that in Department of Highways versus Campbell. Judges are trained to ignore evidence that isn't admissible. And bench trials all the time take place with this. So a judge, as a fact finder, is presumed to ignore any information she obtained in the privilege review. And that's in the Hayward case from California, where the judge did review documents, privileged documents, but the presumption was that the judge would not rely on them at trial. The only way you can say that there is a problem with the judge hearing the case is if there's an indication of favoritism or antagonism. We don't have that. Quite the opposite here. Judge Sturman says she can be fair. Now, the Kirksey case.
What do we make of the standard of review here with Chief Judge Bell's order, where she did review it and found that it was so prejudicial that I suppose Sturman should not have viewed this material? And what then should our standard be? Abuse of discretion or a de novo standard with what Judge Bell did?
Well, first of all, I think that it is what we're looking at is the wrong legal test. So we're not dealing with an abuse of discretion standard here. We're dealing with, did the judge apply the wrong test? She's coming up with this test from the general introduction to Rule 2.11 that says, you know, reasonable doubts. But that's not the standard for judicial exposure. This isn't extrajudicial exposure. This is the judge encountered this in her job as being the judge in the case. Now, I think you are characterizing Judge Bell's ruling as saying these documents are so bad that no judge could ever look at these documents and still wind up being the judge in the case. Well,
Mr. Polzenberg, if I could interrupt you and ask, there's a lot of discussion about extrajudicial doctrines, but how would you define extrajudicial in terms
Something outside the proceedings in the case.
All right, so if something is not evidence in a case and a judge reviews it, is that extrajudicial?
If it's not in the case at all, if it's in the newspaper, then that's extrajudicial.
No, well, I get the newspaper, but for instance, in this case, if this court has already said that the notes at issue were privileged and therefore were non-discoverable, if something is non-discoverable, is it evidence in the case?
I don't use the word evidence, Your Honor. I use the word proceedings. Is the source of the alleged bias proceedings in the case? So here it was proceedings. I mean, otherwise, what we're saying is, if these documents are so bad that no judge could ever be the judge in a bench trial, what are we saying? That the next judge, if the next judge looks at the file too, boom, that judge is out? I mean, that's judicial paternalism, which is funny because we have so little gender bias in this case until that phrase, where we just think a judge would not be able to be fair. And realize the way 2.11 is worded is the judge, in the first place, has the obligation to recuse. So here, the judge has made the determination. So I think we have to wait. They say, let's not wait. We'd have to wait and see whether there's any manifestation of antagonism. Otherwise, anytime a judge reviews something that's inadmissible, under anything, under the hearsay rule, then the judge would not be able to be on the case. You know, a judge in a criminal case could exclude a confession. That doesn't mean the judge has to be off the case.
No,
I see
but
I'm running out of time.
But Mr. Polsenberg, couldn't there be some information that a court might learn that would warrant disqualification because their impartiality could reasonably be questioned?
I think we'd have to go through the steps.
I mean, what if the judge learned in a criminal case that a criminal defendant said something that was, you know, threatening toward the judge or something, and the judge learns about that through the course of the court proceedings? Go ahead.
That's enough. Yeah, that's enough for the judge to recuse herself. That's not enough to disqualify, unless the judge meets the deep-seated favoritism or antagonism standard. And they cite an unpublished decision from the Court of Appeals in Re A.M. Their Judge Harder, his behavior clearly demonstrated that standard. So we can deal with it the way the rule currently operates without having a broad rule saying one judge can decide when another judge can't sit. And I'd like to save my last minute for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Williams?
Good morning. May it please the court. Colby Williams on behalf of the former trustees. I think it may be helpful to start with clearing up a few items in the record, because Mr. Polsenberg didn't have the advantage of participating in the proceedings below, so I just think it'd be helpful to clarify a few things. The first is, with respect to Judge Bula and Judge Sturman, the interaction there, this was not a situation where Judge Sturman referred the notes first to Judge Bula to review them. We had warned Judge Sturman about this issue, but that matter was already pending in front of Judge Bula. And so what we had told Judge Sturman by letter before this issue was ever in front of her, let's wait and see what the Discovery Commissioner does, and then we can visit with respect of what would be the best way to handle this potentially problematic situation, because Judge, we don't want you to become unwittingly tainted. After Judge Bula ruled, it wasn't just us, i.e. the former trustees, who objected to that order or that finding and recommendation. Both parties did, because we weren't just talking about one page of notes or one portion of a page of notes. We were talking about multiple pages, as this court knows from the prior time we were up here. Scott argued none of them were privileged. We argued all of them were privileged. Commissioner Bula found some were, some weren't. That is the record that went up before Judge Sturman. Before Judge Sturman ruled on the objections, we again warned her that moving forward and reviewing these notes would be potentially problematic for her. She decided to go ahead and do that anyway.
Mr. Williams, I mean, what's the point of warning her? She's the judge on the case. It's an evidentiary issue on the case. So you can warn her all you want, but if you expect her to rule on the matter, she has to look at the matter.
I understand that, Justice Kadish. And so what we had proposed was what we believe to be a reasonable solution, which was refer that discrete matter to a different judge in the department to rule on it so that you can stay on the case.
And why would that be warranted in this case as opposed to every other case where courts review matters regarding privilege?
Sure. And I think that goes to the heart of the matter, Your Honor, which is it's dependent on the facts of the case. And in this case, the subject matter of these notes, and I want to be respectful of what Justice Hardesty said at the beginning, I'm certainly not going to get into the content, but there are certain descriptions of these notes that are in the record. And so to the extent I'm permitted to reference matters that are already in the record, I'd like to do so. And that is, going to Justice Silver's question, Scott absolutely, repeatedly argued to Judge Sturman that without these notes, their ability to prove their case would be, quote unquote, thwarted. That is found in the record at 3-App-421, at 4-App-657 to 57 or to 58. In addition to that, Scott argued that the notes were admissions by a party opponent that demonstrate fraud and breach of fiduciary duty. That's at 3-App-421. And so when the notes were being characterized that way, Your Honor, and in addition, the general subject matter, as we've described in the records, these notes reflected the way Mr. Lovers thought Judge Sturman was going to view the case. We suggested, given that particular set of facts, it would be appropriate for another judge to review them. I agree. Most in-camera privilege reviews would not merit referring it to another judge. Totally agree. But given the unique facts here, we thought that it did.
Well, Mr. Williams, as you know, this court you're arguing before today considered the previous appeal and ruled on whether those very documents were privileged or not. Are you arguing we need to be disqualified?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
And I think there's a difference, because this court is not sitting as the trier of fact as Judge Sturman would have been. That's number one. When we came up before you the first time, the question was, are the notes privileged or are they not? And the court made the determination that they were. Had we lost and the notes weren't privileged, then game over. They're in the case, arguably, presuming, you know, other evidentiary standards are met. They're in the case, and the concern doesn't present itself. But the court has found that they are privileged. So if we go forward, we have a trial, one party or the other claims that there's going to be error. This court has held that the notes are inadmissible now. They're non-discoverable. So any error on the merits that gets brought back up to this court is not going to be related to the notes. So I don't think this court is tainted at all for having looked at them in the limited context that it did. So let me talk a little bit, if I might, about this, what I believe to be a per se rule that Scott is arguing for under Kirksey and the extrajudicial source versus the judicial source doctrine, because I think that's really what's at the heart of the case here today. Backing up, our position very quickly was that this matter arose in the middle of the case. Under Tobin Dodge, there's a procedure by which you raise a disqualification issue that comes up in the manner that it did, and we followed that procedure. And Tobin Dodge says, without being modified by any other cases that we found, that the objective standard applies. But the issue with respect to Kirksey and how it interacts with Tobin Dodge, I think, is open to debate, because I don't think the court's had an opportunity to address it. But let's assume that Kirksey does apply to Rule 2.11a when we're talking about a judge's impartiality. And the rule that's being advocated for is that no matter what, if the basis for judicial disqualification is premised on a judicial source, that judge will never be disqualified unless he or she has demonstrated deep-seated favoritism or antagonism that makes fair trial impossible. So unless you've got that, according to Scott, a judge should never be disqualified. And I would submit that type of per se rule goes against the fundamental, the primary policy, as this court has said in the Hogan case, of what the Nevada Code of Judicial Conduct is all about, and that's promoting confidence in the judiciary. That's the first policy, or the primary policy of the code. And so to say to a lower court judge, we are going to handcuff you with respect to evaluating whether a different judge should stay on a case or not with this per se rule, I think does violence to that policy consideration. And I think that there are examples that we have cited to, maybe not a full-blown analysis from a disqualification standpoint, but examples of cases we have pointed to where courts have recognized that there are situations in which, whether it's a judicial, it can come from a judicial source where a court may become tainted based on what they learn or review. The first, which we've been talking about, are in-camera privilege reviews. Not everyone, admittedly. But depending on the contents of the notes, that's one situation. And we've cited four cases for that. And even one of Scott's cases, the Medina case from New Jersey, recognizes that a reasonable observer could certainly question a judge's impartiality depending on what he or she reviews in the context of a privilege review. But more to the point here, and I think this is directly analogous. It may not seem so at first, but I'll get there, I promise. And that's the context of guilty plea negotiations. This court has addressed that in the Cripps case, Justice Hardesty's opinion from 2006. And in that case, the court enacted a bright line rule that said, we are going to remove judges from the guilty plea negotiation process because during that process, and I quote, in the course of plea negotiations, the judge may obtain information about the accused's guilt or innocence that, even if well-intentioned, may diminish judicial objectivity. So we're going to take you out of it so that no one can question that. And if a judge is found to have improperly participated or learns information he or she shouldn't have, the case gets reassigned. We also cited the Plummer case from the D.C. Court of Appeals, which was looking at this very issue in the context of Rule 2.11. The D.C. code is the same as Nevada's. And the argument was, the observation made by the Court of Appeals was that if the judge in that case had actually heard the defendant admit guilt, recusal, quote unquote, clearly would have been required, end quote. And why? Because it would be difficult for any judge to put it out of his or her mind, having learned that information, if the judge was required for whatever reason, because the guilty plea negotiations fell apart or it was withdrawn or what have you, if that judge had to sit on a trial or deal with post-trial motions or do impose sentencing, that's a problem. It's a problem that would be recognized by the public, according to the D.C. Court of Appeals. So how does that apply here? When you look at, and I should back up and say, neither the Cripps case nor the D.C. court, and I'm talking about the Plummer case, was going to wait for the matter to ripen into outward expressions of favoritism antagonism, because they knew, just based on what the judge saw, that's a problem. So here, when you look at the way the notes were characterized by opposing counsel, and when you look at what Judge Bell's findings were about the notes, and again, these are generic comments, I'm not getting into content at all, but that this is from Judge Bell's opinion, that the notes contained opinions that spoke directly on the merits, that they were Mr. Lover's personal assessment of where the former trustees may have risk. That is akin, and I would argue, now I don't agree with the way Scott characterized the notes as being admissions of civil liability, but that's what they were arguing. And so that's what Judge Sturman has been exposed to, and I think the analogy to the judge in a criminal case that hears an admission of guilt is the same. I understand the stakes are different in a criminal case as opposed to a civil case, but what we're talking about at the end of the day is the judge's impartiality. And what would a reasonable, fully informed person on the street think if they knew that the judge had been exposed to that type of information? And I would submit that the process that's applied in the Cripps case, the judge should not be involved in a situation like that, and if he or she is, that the case gets reassigned. That's what should happen here. Chief Judge Bell, I think, is unfairly criticized by the other side in the sense that she's claimed to have, you know, used the wrong standard. And you know, I think given the ambiguity between Kirksey and Toba Dodge, I don't agree with that. But what I do think I can say is Chief Judge Bell, we all recognize, is a very experienced jurist. And when she reviewed the notes, she came away with the opinion that a reasonable person could certainly reasonably question Judge Sturman's ability to continue sitting on the case. Now, we hear a lot about judicial deference or deference to judicial training. And I completely agree that the general rule is that a judge is going to be able to disregard inadmissible evidence or inflammatory evidence. I absolutely agree with that. But what I don't agree with is that that general rule then controls every case. Again, facts matter in these situations, and probably 9 times out of 10, the Kirksey rule or the extrajudicial source versus the judicial source rule would probably be a proper vehicle by which to dispose of disqualification motion. But I think our point at the end of the day is that judges have to have a degree of flexibility for that unique case that comes along, which I would submit this case is. So if we're going to give deference to judicial training as it relates to being able to disregard inadmissible evidence, well, then why do we have to straitjacket that same judge who has that same training with a per se rule that says you don't get to look at the facts of a particular case other than to determine if there's been antagonism or favoritism? And if that's not there, then you can't grant a motion to disqualify. I don't think those two positions are consistent, yet I think that's what Gott is arguing. So with respect to that issue, and unless the court has any further questions of me, I think that the point I would leave that particular issue on is that at the end of the day, if a disqualification case is viewed as a close call, then the authorities recognize that the courts should err on the side of disqualification because it serves that first purpose of the Nevada Code of Judicial Conduct, which is promoting confidence in the judiciary. And so I'll leave that subject, and very briefly, since I have a minute left, I'll just talk about the alternative argument that was made, which was that we had waived the privilege as a result of our inadvertent disclosure below. I think I can handle that very quickly. When Judge Beulah ruled on the matter initially, Scott was an aggrieved party. He found some notes were privileged, some weren't. Otherwise, why did Scott need to object? He objected to Judge Sturman, and he raised that objection in front of Judge Sturman that these notes, for the first time, by the way, raised the argument the notes have been, the privilege has been waived because the notes were recklessly produced. That was argued ad nauseum below. Judge Sturman denied all of those objections, which resulted in basically the same ruling coming up to this court. Some notes were privileged, some notes weren't. Scott was an aggrieved party again. He may have chosen not to raise the waiver argument then, but that's now on him. I would respectfully submit that he doesn't get to gamble and see what the outcome of the argument turns out to be and then raise this thing again, you know, just because we're back in front of either the district court or this court. So with that, I would respectfully submit it and request that the order below be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Paulsenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. So here's what I mean about judicial paternalism. What they're arguing is there are some facts that are just so bad we can't let a judge in the pile, that we can't let a judge see them. So what are we going to do? Hide it from the next judge? Is that what we think of judges? What do we do?
Mr. Paulsenberg, what do you make, though, with that statement you just made? What do you make of the fact that Judge Bell cites to the Arizona Supreme Court in the Lund case, which appears to be very similar to this case? Like, how do you distinguish her citing to that case from this case regarding the privilege here?
And Lund didn't say there was grounds for a disqualification. It didn't find a disqualification. The Arizona court in Lund versus Myers said a judge should consider whether or not to recuse herself. It didn't say it was a disqualification issue.
Well, if the judge should recuse but doesn't, then isn't that a basis for disqualification?
But if disqualification, you'd still have to meet the test of whether there was a deep-seated favoritism or antagonism. And here Judge Sturman says she isn't biased. Let me just address the guilty plea issue just for a second. There, what the court was concerned about, it's judges, and we do the same thing with civil settlement judges. Judges who tried the case coercing a settlement. That was the issue in that case. And remember, in Kirksey, Judge Lehman heard that the defendant wanted the death penalty, and he still wasn't recused. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate your excellent arguments today, Mr. Paulsenberg and Mr. Williams. In the briefing in this case, the case will stand submitted and the court will be in recess. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.